Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 243 of the podcast. And I'm joined in conversation by Benjamin Dennehy. Benjamin is known as the UK's most hated sales trainer. And today we unlock his sales secrets that you too can action. Expect to learn where on earth the title of the UK's most hated sales trainer comes from and how Benjamin has built his brand and his business to escape from a life and a career that he quite simply didn't want to be involved in. I ask about the biggest mistakes that salespeople make, why sales isn't treated like a profession, how to be trusted rather than liked, the fundamentals of a good cold call, and just how Benjamin is so good at bouncing back questions to direct the conversation and the flow of where things are going in exactly the way that he wants to. This episode is packed with sales insights, of course it is, but we also dive into things like psychology and how you can better understand yourself, but also those around you. And I would honestly say that some of the career and business advice that Benjamin gives as this podcast progresses is really, really helpful if you are somebody, which I expect you are, that wants to live life on your own terms. This episode is brought to you by my podcast Masterclass. That's the video learning platform that I've built to help you start, sustain, and scale your own podcast. Over the last 4 years, and it is now officially 4 years as of the start of April, I've grown the show to the top 1% globally. And along the way, it has opened so many doors for me when it comes to my business, my personal brand. I've added incredible contacts to my network and so much more that I cannot even put into words. But most podcasts that start fail. Over 90% don't make it past episode 8, and many that do never really build a consistent high quality of upload and a guest pipeline that they really want to have within their field. My podcast masterclass solves all of that, and it will give you the foundations, the systems, and the processes to smash through those earlier barriers and really grow something that means something in your niche. The link to enroll will be in the show notes, and it's mypodcastmasterclass.thinkific.com, and it has over 54 video modules to walk through so you can go from scratch all the way to a credible show that has the systems and processes in place to continue to push on and scale. That's quite enough for me. Before this introduction finishes, I want to make sure that you've navigated your finger or your thumb to that subscribe or follow button. We've hit some record numbers. The episode with Zuby that went out on Wednesday there has had an incredible reaction so far, some record downloads for its first few days, and I massively appreciate the support along the way. I know many of you are already doing this, but if you're enjoying this episode, take the time to share the link with a friend, post it to your LinkedIn, post it to your Instagram. Let's get the show out there as it continues to grow, continues to rage on, and I continue to get the highest quality possible guests. And one of those is Mr. Benjamin Dennehy, and that's going to be in your ears for the next hour and 5 minutes after the music plays. Benjamin, welcome to the show. Ready for this one?
I am, very much so. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, I thought so. And I wanted to start off by asking you about the impact that the book How to Run Your Own Life had on you and your trajectory.
Oh, that's a good question. Straight off the bat too, I like it. So I was introduced to that book by a colleague, a friend, Marcus. Must have been back in 2012, probably, over 10 years ago. And I read it, and it had a huge impact on my life because this book's fascinating how it gets you to try and figure out why you do what you do and why you're behaving the way you're behaving. And I won't go into the personal side because it's a very personal issue, but I was pursuing something many years ago that I always thought I wanted to do. And I was adamant. And my wife used to say to me, why do you want to do this? It doesn't seem to bring you any pleasure. You don't seem to like it. Why you do? And I said, I don't know. I just feel. So anyway, I read this book, and the little alien gets you to start questioning yourself and digging deeper into yourself. And I started thinking, where did the idea for this idea come from? And then I was able to trace it all the way back to being 10 years old in the library at school, reading a history book and seeing this particular person achieve something. And this 10-year-old kid said, I want to do that. And that stuck with me right through to my late 30s, I guess, mid to late 30s. And I suddenly realized, I did what the book said. I said, would you take career advice from a 10-year-old now? It's like, well, no. So why are you listening to your 10-year-old self? And it was this a moment of epiphany. That's like, yeah. So I let go of this particular pursuit that I wanted to pursue. And that freed me up to focus on what I was meant to be doing, which was sales training and sales. So it had a huge impact. And I give that book to all of my clients. I tell every one of my clients to read that book. And every single one of them, without fail, phones up or sends a message saying, this book is amazing. I said, I know. It's so hard to buy. You try and Google it, right? And it ranges from 500 quid to $2,000. It's the weirdest book in the world. I managed to get a hard copy, like whatever it was, for 20 quid. I've still got the hard copy. But yeah, it's a book that if you're watching this, How to Run Your Own Life, if you can get a copy of it, then I would suggest reading it. I really would, because it did change my trajectory completely.
It's so important in our lives to have self-awareness of what we actually want. And when you have something that a pattern interrupt, which I'm sure we're going to speak about as this conversation goes, it gives you an opportunity to zoom out, take a wanky corporate term, helicopter view of your life, and be like, why am I actually doing these things? Is it in alignment with my true values, or is it in alignment with society's expectations, with my 10-year-old self's expectations and aspirations? Or is it what I really want at this moment in time based on my true self and who I am? And there was a phrase that a recent guest, Frankie Lee, used in the podcast, having your ladder up against the wrong wall.
Yes.
And many people find themselves in that situation where they're climbing these rungs and the drive is there for some reason, but it's not truly there. So you won't necessarily do the thing that you need to do at the moment when it's hardest. You're just sort of going through the motions because that's what you think you should do. So many people nowadays, with our education system, in my generation in particular, they go to university because that's the done thing. They do the degree, they get the graduate job, they get the mortgage, and they're just kind of on this track to like this classic normal life. And at some point they're like, oh shit, this wasn't what I wanted whatsoever. Now don't get me wrong, some people are happy in that because it's relatively easy, but some people reflect on it and think, God, no, this is not what I truly want. So I think it's great when I have these conversations and people have sources or frameworks that they've used to identify, am I pushing in the right direction? And for it to happen in your mid to late 30s is later on in the journey, but still vital that it happened, because look at what you've achieved in the last 5 or 6 years. If you look at your brand and your business now and the lifestyle that you live.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. The focus fundamentally changed, and I could focus on what mattered, and I was able to get really serious about it. So a lot of people have said to me, you've done well. People only ever see the finished product. They never see it's like the iceberg, right? They only ever see the top. They don't see the underneath that it took to get there. And what a lot of people didn't know is that in order to get really, really good at this, I've been in sales since like 2004. And I've been prospecting mainly. I was a professional prospector, which probably is like being a coal miner in a digital era, right? So there I was every day in the coal face trying to set appointments on behalf of clients. And I was sitting at my desk one day and I said to myself, I'm going to be doing this in my 50s. I don't want to be doing this in my 50s. I need to figure out a way out of this. And I thought, well, I like selling, so I'm going to go into more. So I started talking to all my clients, how do you do what you do and why do you do what you do? And they used to let me come on the meetings, and I'd sit in these sales meetings and I'd see people. And no one could sell, but I didn't know how to sell either. And I remember saying, this is all wrong. And, well, this is why it is, Benjamin. Trust me, I've been doing this for years. And it's like, all right, fine. So that drove me to try and figure out how people buy and how to sell. And I was obsessed with it, and so much so that when I thought I'm going to be a sales trainer, but I need to master selling first before I can teach it. So I set up a business, and I said to my wife, though, I said, the problem I have here is I'm making all this money from prospecting, so we have a safety net. I said, I'm not pushing myself. So I said, this is what we're going to do then. I'm going to fire all my clients and we're going to complete cold turkey. And until I master this, we're living on our credit cards and what limited savings. We had a new baby. We were living in a rented apartment, and I said, the worst case scenario is bankruptcy. I said, we're not going to be homeless because we live in the West. The government isn't going to let you be homeless. So we're not going to be homeless. Worst case scenario is we're going to be bankrupt and we'll lose everything. And I said, well, we don't really have anything now. So we've got nothing to lose. We just go back to zero. So I said, if you're up for the ride, I said, let's do it. She said, I trust you. I said, fine. And I nearly went bankrupt. I was about 45K in debt, 8 different credit cards. It was It was tough. But every time I wanted to quit, I discovered the easiest way not to quit is to ask yourself a question. And the question was, if I mastered this, if I was competent at it, would it work? And the answer was always yes. So the next question was, is do you want to quit or do you want to push through? Those are the only two choices. And it's like, well, if I quit, I just go back to where I'm from with even less. So that was hard. I was like,
But it's a great question to ask yourself. It's a great question to ask yourself because I think just based on the personality type that I've got to know through your content over the last 3-4 years, you are someone that is resilient. Yes. And you have to be in order to work in sales or to teach people how to work in sales, and you have to walk the walk in order to be credible in this space. But when you have that resounding belief in yourself, when it does come to the crunch and you've used sources like how to run your own life and you've had conversations with your loved ones and everyone's up for pulling in the same direction, it is much easier to go through those phases where you are teetering the brink, as you explained, and keep going, because that's such a difficult thing for so many people. And there is the option of going towards the comfort again.
Yeah, and I've talked people close to me out of setting up their own business, because you ask them, well, why do you want to do it? And I go, well, I want to make more money. I go, everyone wants to make more money. You don't have to quit your job and set up a business to do that. And then when you dig deeper, I go, does your wife, because most people I know are Matt, does she agree? And it's the number of times the wife said, no, I don't. And I said, look, don't do it. If your wife's not going to support you doing this, you're, and the only reason you want to do it is to make more money. You're going to spend the first 3 years fighting about how you don't have money, because that's what it's going to be like in order to grow a business. So you're not going to make your life any better. It's going to be worse. You're going to end up getting divorced. Figure out another way to make money. Don't do it. And so I've had friends say, yeah, that's good advice, because it's hard without the support of your loved ones, particularly your closest one, if you're married or you've got a partner, then it won't work. Because if they start grumbling and moaning, and they're not behind it, you'll give in. You'll give in, and you'll get divorced, which is even worse. Divorce over money. That's stupid.
Yes, agreed. Yeah. So you were booking these prospecting meetings for your clients. You decided to go along to them. You saw how things were done was just not correct. Terrible. It was poor. What were some of the major deficiencies that you saw in that time and that still exist within the sales world?
Well, it still exists. The number one is I would say 95% of people in sales deep down don't want to be there. That's the fundamental cardinal problem. Yeah, you meet someone who's a lawyer or a doctor or a physicist or a mathematician. You say, well, you know, how did you become a lawyer? They don't say, oh, I fell into it. You know, I didn't know what to do, so I thought, solid, I'll study law for the next 5 years and qualify. No, they've always wanted to be it. They've had a drive or a passion. It's been a calling, and they call these things a calling. Most people in sales, when you say, what did you want to be when you grow up? No one ever says, I wanted to be a salesman. So how are you here? I needed a job. That's right. You went to university. You did 4 years doing English Lit or art history or French linguistics or something stupid, gender studies, something really stupid that no one's going to pay you for. But at least you're educated. You speak well and you look okay. So you're qualified to enter sales. That's the barrier to entry. As long as you don't dribble in the interview, you are qualified. And so you get in it. And after 2 years of being in sales, you realize either you have to go off and retrain to something completely different or you're stuck. There is no people say sales is the greatest profession in the world. What transferable skill is there from being a salesman? Really? I've never seen a job saying wanted ex-salesman. No, if you're in sales, you're in sales. So most salespeople are just, they died years ago, but they're just going through the motions. You know?
One of the key things you've said there though, Benjamin, is you use the term profession and you rally against the fact that many salesmen don't treat their career like a profession. They pretty much just turn up and wing it. Why do you think that is?
Again, most people buy into the lie that selling is the gift of the gab and that it's the art of convincing. It's also about volume. So salespeople created phrases like you've got to be in it to win it, and it's a numbers game and all of this. But actually, if you look, they didn't create that. Those are all jingles for the lottery. Those are all strap lines for the lottery. So for most salespeople, it's a lottery. But if you buy enough lottery tickets, eventually you'll win. And so there's no skill in that. And as I say, would you hire a lawyer if you ask them, so why do you win all the time? I've got a great personality. No, seriously, why do you win? No, I look good in a wig and juries like me. No, that's bollocks. Why do I win? Do you know how many trials of these I've done? I know every question to ask. I know when to ask it. I know what to challenge. I know when not to challenge. I know when to look at a jury in a certain way. I know when to raise my... I know everything. From the moment I walk in there, I know what I'm doing. Same with a surgeon or a golfer or the Red Arrows. You know, they don't just go up there and make it up as they go along. Salespeople don't do that. They love the idea of winging it, because if you wing it, there's no accountability, because they take all the glory when they win. But when they lose, wasn't their fault. Wrong time, bad product, didn't have the budget, wrong pricing, competitor got in. It's never my fault, Gov. Yeah? Whereas a lawyer or a surgeon or a pilot, if something goes wrong, they look at what they did. They said, you screwed up. You're to blame. Salespeople hate that. Yeah? And so they avoid it like the plague. So they just wing it. And
that,
yeah.
That lack of personal accountability, you're completely correct. There's always other factors at play. And
always.
Having worked across a few different industries in my sales career, I completely agree. There are times where your brand is important, your product's important. But in terms of actually generating those first contact meetings, that making that first impression, there's so much that you can control in your approach and your process, which is going to be a key term that I'm sure we're going to get into, that actually empowers you versus this kind of slapdash, convoluted approach that varies depending on what side of bed you woke up that morning, or how much coffee you've had, or how enthusiastic you're feeling, or how motivated you are to hit your target at this point in time because, oh my God, I've got this particular thing coming up that I need to work hard for. And I find it fascinating that so many people don't have the same regimented approach that they would have to other professions, as you're explaining, in sales.
Well, the thing is, a lot of salespeople are incapable of separating their identity from their role. So they're a salesman. That's what they are. Whereas the reason barristers in the English system, they put on a wig and gown, it's so that everyone knows that there's an advocate there. There's not a human. My client could be the worst human being on earth. I hope they get convicted and die in prison. But I have to stand up in court and say, Your Honor, this is one of the most noble and learned men I've met. He made a terrible mistake. And you argue, okay. And then when you go and take off the wig and gown, the human underneath can say, God, I'm glad we lost that. But when you're in there, you're the advocate, just like a surgeon. So salespeople don't do that. They sort of live and breathe. They sort of, I'm a salesman. And so they're emotionally attached to what's going on. Whereas I've created my own stupid uniform, braces, hat. So when I go to work, when I go out and do my stuff, this is my uniform. This is my advocate role. But when I go home, I get to take it off. Doesn't matter how bad my day was as an advocate, the person underneath, the human being, I'm completely fine. And that's professionalized. I detach myself. I don't care if I win or lose. I'm never going into a meeting. I've got to win. I've got to get the deal. It's no. I'm going to focus on what I have to. Whatever happens at the end, I may not like it, but if I do my job well, the outcome's probably right. So many salespeople don't do that. They're constantly got to get the deal, got to get the meeting, got to get the sale, and they're focused on the wrong thing.
The fear of rejection is such a huge barrier for so many salespeople. And you just simply by creating an identity between 9 to 5 or whatever hours you work, absolutely allows you to detach that from your self-worth outside of that. And I think self-worth is a really key term, because you've spoken many times before about how needy many salespeople are for validation, but not even validation from the deal. And one of my biggest challenges with people that I've worked with across the years in different companies is they get the excitement and the buzz, as you were saying, the validation from when the deal goes well, but when the process doesn't go well, or even when they maybe get to a stage where they have to put on the corporate hat and be a bit more thorough in their process and their presentation, they lose the interest that they had when they were getting to chase the deal down in the first place. So I love that there's an opportunity for somebody to detach from, like, if we're going to use my corporate calling versus the other calling outside of that.
Yeah, you have to detach from what's happening. My job as a salesman, and again, it's the mindset and the beliefs. Most people in sales have the wrong beliefs because no one's given the right beliefs. And so they believe that the person with the money makes the rules. Sales is the guy with the money is in charge. Well, they got the money. It's their money. They get, yeah. The only thing the person with the money has is choice of where they spend it. That's it. But I always say to people, if this pen, if you can see it, if this was the cure for cancer, right, the cure. Now Elon Musk came to me, world's richest man, and he's got this cancer and this cures it. And he says, Benjamin, I'll give you $1 billion for it. And I say, no, I don't like you. I'll give you 2. No, I hope you die. 3. I'll give you everything I have. No, I don't want your money. Money is powerless in his case, he'd hire someone to kill me. But in the rest of the world, right? Money is powerless unless someone wants to take it. It's a medium of exchange. The problem is salespeople always go in wanting to take the money, and prospects know that. So therefore, you're always unequal. Whereas I don't need your money. I'd like it. It'd be nice to have it. But I'm here to figure out why you should be my customer, not why you should buy from me. I'm not here to justify this company. We built a factory that makes widgets, and we know those widgets work because we sell these all over the world. Why the hell would I justify my life to you? No, convince me why we should sell you these widgets that are going to fix your problem and make your life better.
It's a huge shift from scarcity to abundance. How do you recommend people do that? Because so many salespeople are in a place of scarcity because you did mention a critique of volume there, but many people don't have enough activity going on to come from a place of abundance. So I know that I can say no to potential clients because I've got a big enough pipeline, but many people are not in that position. So they do come in on their hands and their knees in that position of neediness. How do you recommend somebody moves from scarcity towards this abundance mindset that you're taking up?
Well, I've always said that selling is a West End show played by a psychiatrist. You've got to be an actor and you've got to understand human psychology. And part of your job as a salesperson is to be an actor. I can't go on and be Benjamin Dennehy, the human being, because I'll lose more than I'll win and that'll hurt. So the character I create has to die. And the character I create is financially independent and can take it. So when I used to prospect, I would deliberately sit back, put my legs up, act like a fat cat tycoon. I'd be sitting there in boxers and a t-shirt. My wife would say, but you always sounded like a slightly angry CEO. Hear you on the phone. Yeah, I mean, it's a character, but I can only do that for a couple of hours at a time and I was exhausted because that's not me as a person. Most salespeople go in being them and then they get rejected and they hurt. Whereas my character gets rejected. My character is a financially independent CEO. Doesn't need the money. You have to act like that. I tell salespeople, when you're out selling, it's your business. You're not there on behalf of the MD. You got to act like it's your business. And you talk to them like they're your equal. You're not rude. You're not arrogant, because people that are successful don't tend to be rude and arrogant, but they're comfortable in their skin. I know our product works. I need you to convince me why you need it. And it changes the script. You start using that language. Convince me. Why should I help you? I don't understand why you need us. Convince me. I don't get it. There's a cheaper way to fix this. And it's amazing what prospects do to win your business when you try to convince them they don't need it.
You've given really good examples of that. And given that your customer base were CEOs or decision makers that we're going to hire for sales training, it makes total sense that you create a character that is on a level with them, because you rally really strongly against people by people as a phrase, because it's such an easily thrown around term, isn't it?
It's because it's a nonsense, because they missed two words off the end of the sentence, which fundamentally, it's people by people like them, right? So two fat guys in Hawaiian shirts will probably sell to each other. You get a big fat guy in a Hawaiian shirt up against a pin stick insect of an accountant in a pinstripe suit. The odds of them doing business, it's not impossible, but it's going to be far harder because they're so misaligned. And as a species, we're drawn to people like us. When you walk into a room full of strangers, you look for someone you know, and then you gravitas towards them. So when people are out selling, they like to buy from people like them. So when you meet people that say he's a natural salesman, what has happened is by chance, by hook or by crook, they've fallen into a sector where they sell to people like them and they've never realized it. And you see salespeople when they say, oh, my client, we get on, we're mates. Yeah, have you seen how alike you are? But they forget the 80% of people that didn't buy from them, that didn't like them and that weren't like them. And they say, wrong time. They got all the excuses. So once you realize that, you can start changing how you prospect. So I deliberately target people like me. Why would I target people not like me? So if you realize you've got a personality like mine, you go after CEOs or MDs. If you're more of a Poindexter, if you're into facts and figures, then I'd be going after finance directors, accountants, engineers, people that are like you. But you don't, me and an accountant? No, they would hate me. Lawyers, I could help lawyers, but they wouldn't do what I do. It's like, no, but the same guy, same material taught by someone that looked and sounded like them, they'd lap it up.
So it resonates so much more.
Yeah. You've got to give your prospect the personality they want, not the one you want to give them.
And I think it's really good that you recognize for the 2 hours a day that you do that, that takes a lot of energy to do, because then you're focused on creating that. Equally, the more customers you work with that are less of an act or less of an identity change for you, the greater longevity you perhaps have in those particular hours across a period of time as well. I know that I radically adopt my style based on the different customer base that I deal with. So in my day job, we sell furniture into student accommodation. Sometimes I'm dealing with a landlord that's got a portfolio of like 20 properties, and he could be very, very direct, very, very straight. Sometimes it's the head of estates at a university department, and you have to be very prim and proper. I go to that meeting much more smartly dressed. I don't swear. Whereas the landlord who's got 20 investment properties, he's wanting to talk about the pounds and the pence and that fucking sofa you bought me last year. Like, he's going to be much more firm on it. So you adapt your style and you mirror and you understand that. And my emails are radically different in length and detail depending on who I'm dealing with, because you must be adaptive for them, because as you say, people buy from people like them. So try and mirror some of those traits. And people really do appreciate when you speak to them in their own language. I know we're all speaking English, but there's different forms of that.
100% agree. You have to give them the character that they're most comfortable with. And a lot of salespeople do that. They go in and go, I want to show them my presentation, my creds, my, and I want to show that. And it's like, no, that will only work on someone like you who's interested in that. And they just don't get that. But because I've had some success, they hold on to it. They always forget the 80% of people that told them to sod off, because the brain will always find evidence to justify what it wants to believe. Right? So you can always point to people that bought from you doing what you do. Well, of course you can. Of course you can. But let's look at the 8 out of 10 that said no. Why did they not buy? And then they give the excuse. No, it's got nothing to do with those excuses. They bought from someone else the same product. What was different about them? The way they went about conducting themselves in front of the prospect. Yeah. So it is a form of acting. It's theater.
Given it's acting, how much is process versus improv? Because I know that you're very process driven, but there has to be an element of being light on your toes to some extent.
So the system sets you free. So it's like a fish. A fish in water has got all the flexibility that it wants. Take it out of water and it'll die. It's the same with it. So I rigidly follow a structure because I need to know where I am. But within that structure, I have incredible flexibility. But the structure is designed to keep me on track. And if I don't stay on track, the prospect will put me into their system. So I call it the sales matrix, right? And the sales matrix, when I explain this to everyone in business, they all recognize it. The sales matrix is a prospect expects you to show up, to answer their questions, to give a presentation. This bit goes well. This is when everyone's getting along and they're asking great questions. Do you do this? Do you do that? Can you do this? Have you helped us here? Yes, we can do that. You're answering and no. It's going well. And they know once this bit of the meeting's over, you, Mr. Salesman, are going to try and close me. I know that. So I'm ready for it. I've already got my get out of jail free card. So the moment you say, I've really enjoyed this chat. So how do you want to move this forward? What's the next step? Where do you want? Then I throw up stalls, objections, or higher authority or something. Look, I've really enjoyed this chat, but I can't make this decision myself. I got to go run it by X, Y, and Z. And you'll go, but you told me on the phone you were the decision maker. Oh, did I lie to you? Sorry, I'm allowed to lie to a salesman to get you in. Or our budgets aren't set until next quarter. Or could you send me something? You know, I don't, And so you know that's coming as a salesman. You know they're probably not going to commit. You know it. And you also know you're going to have to do a proposal or a quote or send them something. And you still do it every time in the hope that someone will send it back with bought on it. And it doesn't happen. But when it does happen, you forget the 9 times out of 10 that process didn't work. And when you look at it, the person controlling it is the prospect. The person with the money is always in control. And that is an up here problem, because no one can force you to do it. You choose to do it because you're too chicken to challenge the process. Now, hold up. This isn't your meeting. It's mine. I'm not here to convince you of why you should use us. I know this works. I need to be convinced why we should sell to you. So, and it flips it. Now, people hearing this will say, well, that's bullshit. You can't do that. You can. You just got to learn how to do it. And obviously, I'm being rather flippant because this is an interview and not a sale.
Exactly that. And equally, when you take that mindset that you're going to lead the way, I always try and look at myself as a trusted advisor for my prospect, and I build that level of rapport where they see me as a subject matter expert with customers who are just like them, and I can map out how we move from A to B, and it's much more easy to take the lead and be somebody that guides them in that sense, rather than if you come in needy, on your knees, listening to their questions, and then, as you say, trying to desperately try and scramble for a close at the end. And one of the biggest things that my fear in my day job is when I present that quote or that proposal and I've not gained commitment, I end up in the sales graveyard and that kind of ping pong on the phone where I'm phoning back and forth to say, have you had a chance to look at the proposal yet? And we haven't agreed the firm next steps or built commitment in that meeting that what I send through, if I can get it to X, Y, or Z, or if I can produce it like this, are you going to move forward? Will you be sending me a PO? What is the next step? And I know that you're somebody that's really strong at being able to have something firm come out of that first interaction.
Oh, yeah. I'm willing to walk away with a no or a next step. And the next step isn't, I'll go and do something for you. No. That's me being servile. The next step is, if A doesn't happen, then there's a consequence. So just the other day, I was contacted by a managing director, and he said he was interested in doing some training. And this is through email. And I always direct people to book a call because I charge consult calls to talk to me, because I realized many years ago that 90% of people that approach you are just trying to steal your information for free. They just want to get on the phone and have a chat. Yeah, but what they really want is free consulting, which is how they see us salespeople. We are biological Googles. We are a source of information for free. So they just phone us up and pretend they're interested.
You can provide a barometer for their pricing against your competitor, yeah, or they can just soundboard off if they even want to look at this area.
Yeah, we've already decided to go with ABC Company, but we want to come to you because we know you're the second best in the market, and we just want to get sort of roughly your thoughts on this to reaffirm the decision that we've made. But they don't tell you that, obviously, because you wouldn't do it if you knew. So they lie to you and they prevaricate. And he said to me, I said, well, look, book a consult call. And he goes, I don't want to pay for a call. I said, well, that's fine. You don't have to. I go, I'm assuming you're talking to other trainers. He goes, yes. And I go, how much did they charge you to talk to them? He said, nothing. I said, so can I ask you a blunt question? Why would you want a sales trainer that gives away his time for free to come and train your people? And he goes, that's a good question. I said, so you either pay the consult call, we figure out if you want to sell the way I teach, or you go with one of these guys who's probably acting the way your guys already are. So I don't care. No, he'll come back or he won't. Either way, if he doesn't come back, he was never going to do what I teach. If he does come back, I've got a client for the next 6 to 12 months. Either
this
way,
into your method as well. That's so key. And I definitely want to get into how you start dynamics when you're prospecting and the cold calling side of things, because that's one of the first times that I came across your contract and that kind of infamous call that you did on a podcast live. But I really do think that how you set those interactions at an early stage, it sets the dynamic, and you can see why it's much easier for you to carry on in that vein of being on an equal footing and leading the conversation when you start on that level. Whereas if you do start on your knees, it's very, very difficult to get back up and to try and be on an even footing when it comes to negotiating how you're going to work with somebody. And as you say, that particular MD, he's much more likely to understand that you're going to radically change how his salespeople hold themselves, carry themselves, and conduct themselves, because you start on that footing and you practice what you preach. Whereas if you were subservient to him, his salespeople are already behaving in a subservient manner that's not allowing them to generate the revenue they can do.
And this is how I disqualify up people to work with, because if they don't want that, if they don't like what I'm doing, what they're telling me is, I don't really want to change. I'm not really looking, but I just need a ticker box that says we gave them some sort of training. It's like, well, that's not going to work. Then you're going to bitch at me. Oh, we hired this guy, Benjamin, said he's really, really good. And nothing changed. No, of course it's not going to change if you're not going to change, you know? So I'm brutal. I'm trying to get rid of people rather than sell to them. And if I can't get rid of you, then there's a good chance we're probably going to end up doing business together. Because there's more reasons for you not to buy from me than there are. Salespeople forget that. So it's easier to try and get rid of them rather than try and convince them why they should buy from you. Just keep telling them, yeah.
What are some of the questions for disqualifying prospects?
Well, for instance, I said to this guy, can I ask you a question? These other salespeople you're talking to, sales trainers, yeah. I go, are they from your industry? He goes, yes. So they're used to training. I said, so why the hell don't you just go with them then? Why would you hire someone like me that's a complete unknown? He goes, well, I've been following you online. I like what you said. Yeah, I know, but it's going to be awfully hard. Yeah, I know that, but we're looking for something different. Now, you know, if I were you, I would just stick with – I don't want to go with someone from an industry. And they start to argue with you. So my whole job is to get – if they can't fight for their position of change, then they're never going to use me. Why don't you just put your prices up? We can't. Why? That's the easiest way to make more money. All you got to do is we can't. Why? Competitive environment. Okay, fine. Okay, why don't you just fire your worst salespeople? That's going to save you, what, 60, 100K? Just get rid of the losers. No, I want to invest in them. Okay, hire better ones then. No, we don't want to hire people. So you don't want to hire people. You don't want to fire people. You don't want to put your prices up. Why don't you poke someone from one of your biggest competitors? You know, that little black book of contacts. No, done that before. Yeah, how'd that work out? It's crap. Okay, just outsource it then. There's all those outsourcing companies. I go through all the alternatives and they argue with me why none of them are valid. Now we're left with training. Ah, so can you help us? I don't know. I mean, convince me. If we are going to do this, are you going to change? And I can go down. So this is my job. I'm not here to try and sell to you. I'm here for you to convince me why I should let you buy from me.
There's the methodology. I love it. I really enjoy that. Right. Let's get into the fundamentals of a good cold call. What does that involve?
So a good cold call, most people don't understand the purpose of a cold call. Whenever you ask salespeople, what's the purpose of a prospecting call? You get a range of answers. It'll be like, well, to get an appointment, to find pain, to find need. It's like, no, those are outcomes. Those are possible outcomes. But what is the purpose is different from outcome. Just like if you ask a lawyer, what's the purpose of a trial? They won't say to get an acquittal, to get a conviction. Those are outcomes. The purpose is some noble grand for the, you know, the impartial hearing of evidence and da-da-da-da-da. It's noble. So what's the purpose of a prospecting call? The purpose of a prospecting call is to find a human being who is sitting at their desk, happy as Larry, not feeling anything about what you fix. And by the end of it, having them going, okay, maybe you got something. I'm not trying to sell. All I'm doing is trying to find someone that can recognize the problems I fix and is able to answer a few questions about it, enough for me to say, you may have an issue that needs fixing. I don't know yet. That's what the sales meeting's for. What we have is a group of symptoms that indicate you have a pain, but upon proper diagnosis, the pain may not be big enough, or the pain would be something I can't fix. I don't know. So the purpose is to get someone a little bit emotional about whatever I fix. So that's the purpose, which means I can't do it to everyone. Salespeople are trying to get everyone to say yes. No. If I had the cure for COVID, say, and I only wanted to talk to people with COVID, what would you ask people about? You'd ask them about the symptoms. You'd say, most people I talk to have a runny nose, achy joints, and they've lost their sense of taste and smell. You recognize any of that? And they say no. And I go, well, can I still come in anyone and talk to you about this?
Move on. Yes.
So most people I'll talk to won't experience these, but then I'll phone someone up and I'll go, well, I do have a sore throat. Now, that sore throat, it could be a form of cancer. It could just be the common cold. I don't know. Oh, but you do have a sore throat. Can I ask a few questions about that? Okay, well, look, there may be something in the mind. Why don't we have a meeting to determine whether or not this is worth exploring further? That's the purpose of prospecting. It's not to get everyone to say yes. I'm looking for people with symptoms for me to go in and diagnose.
And at this is where one of the times when I came across your content, Benjamin, you were rallying against people that do too much research before they call. And it kind of bristled with me because I like to be well-researched. You probably see that from the podcast when I ask you a question like your favorite book. But when I understood where you were coming from, you want people to be well-researched about the symptoms that their ideal client profile have, not necessarily everything about that particular client. Yes. And that is where many people, as you were saying, they don't really know what they solve with their product or their service. Right. So they don't know what to ask for. Because in the same way you're bringing up COVID symptoms, you can do it in any particular field. Like for me, it could be replenishment of furniture every single summer, or churn items like mattresses, beds. Like, what do you buy? I need to understand what I bring to the table and what they potentially need help with, whether it's changing to a more sustainable product, changing to a more durable product, whatever it is. That's fantastic that I understand that, but I need to ask and search for that. And if it's not them, move on to the next one, because there's going to be somebody out there that wants it.
Yeah, so you're looking for people who have problems you fix. So you have to talk about what you fix, not how you do it or why you do it, because no one cares. I don't care how you do it. I don't care if you've got the most green, sustainable, All I'm interested in is, will your sustainable furniture last 2 years for X amount? If you can convince me of that, then I will buy from you. So it's just like a doctor doesn't need to know everything about your life to be able to ask you, do you have A, B, or C? No. Well, then you don't need to come and see me. Yeah, no, it's all right. I researched your entire family. I know everything about you. Now I'm going to ask you if you have these symptoms. You don't have to do it. Research is a form of procrastination. It's a way of avoiding picking up the phone. I don't need to know. Companies say to me, how do you do it so quickly? I said, well, what is your product fix? So I remember this. I was working with a company. They sell magnetic switches to the oil and gas and nuclear industry. And he said, we're really struggling to get in front of people with this. And I said, well, what does this fix? And they give me the usual. I said, no. What does it actually fit? Why would anyone want this as opposed to a competitor? And they started to explain three things. Well, most of our competitors' stuff don't work out of the box. 10% don't work. I said, well, that would suck. What else? Lead time. It can take up to 3 months to get these from our competitor. We can deliver these in 4 weeks. I go, okay, that's good. What else? Sometimes these things break because water leaks into them because of the... I said, I've got all I need now. I said, give me the phone. So I picked up the phone, phoned an engineer. I don't know anything about nuclear industry. I don't know anything about oil. Don't know anything about engineering. Get through to an engineering director. And I said, so look, we work with a lot of companies that have to use ABC switch, but a lot of them are frustrated that when water gets in it, it breaks. Others say what pisses them off is that it can take up to 12 weeks to get a batch of these delivered. And a few say what's really annoying is when they open the box, about 10% of these don't work. Now, I bet you're going to tell me you don't recognize that, though. And the guy just says, I can relate to all of that, mate. I said, no, you can't have all. He goes, I do. I said, well, you got to pick one. If you only fix one, which would it pick? He said, lead time. I go, tell me about that. And then at the end of a 8-minute conversation, he'd agreed to get samples sent to him. And he was paying for the cost of for the sample to go out. And the guy said, how did you do that? Because I've been doing this 20 years. You've been here 2 hours. I said, because I wasn't. You don't need to know anything to sell. It's just, what does this fix and will my prospect relate to it?
Yes, and you elicited an emotional reaction in him to something that he wanted to seek a solution from. I'm a big fan of that. And there was far more questions than there was telling him, because it's very easy for him to say, oh yeah, like for example, it's so frustrating, the lead time. Then salesperson would start to throw up about, well, the good news is our switches are available within 12 weeks. You've already lost the game by that point because you haven't built enough commitment to deliver that yet.
You haven't got him to admit that the 12-week lead time hurts him. You've just got him to acknowledge it's a symptom, but a lot of people are willing to live with their symptoms and pains because some people like misery. So it's not enough. So I've got to dig deeper. So when he said lead time, I said, well, what do you mean? I know what he means, but I said, what do you mean? It forces him to tell me a story. He goes, we ordered a batch of these about 6 months ago, and it took about, he goes, I think it was 16 weeks to get it. And then I drop in a motive. I go, that must be frustrating. And he goes, yes. And then I go deaf. I said, sorry, I missed that. He goes, yes, it's frustrating. So I'm deliberately manipulating. I want him to start. I go, so how long has this been going on for? He goes, it's been going on for years. I go, no. I go, so when you phoned up ABC company and said, hey, guys, can you get these to us faster? What did they say? He said, oh, you know, they said, we'll try. And I go, well, I guess that must have worked then. He goes, no. I said, sorry, I missed it. He goes, no. He's now said no to it. So now he doesn't see it, but I'm manipulating him to get him. And as we're doing this in role play, you'll be people watching and say, nah, that wouldn't work if you did in the real world. It does, because human beings are programmed to answer questions. And if the question is a good one about them, what's the number one thing people love talking about?
Themselves.
So if I ask good questions that get them to talk about them, people don't shut up. And especially if it's about something they can whinge about, because we love moaning about things. That's what I'm in. I'm in the business of finding pain. I don't create it. I just find it. And sometimes people are aware they have it. Sometimes they don't know they have it until you point it out to them. Huh? Actually, now you put it like that, I do recognize that. That's it. Simple.
One of the traits and behaviors that I've noticed on your cold calls is that you answer with a question back rather than an answer, in the same way we were talking there. Some people may find that frustrating. Is there a particular best practice that enables you to not drive somebody up the wall, but to continue them moving through your process?
So what do you mean? Say that again.
So for example, if you're replying with a question to their question, they can find that frustrating potentially, couldn't they? So if I say to you,
just, Did you see? I just did it to there. So I get this all the time. I get people. The people that do that are ones that deep down know it'll work, but they don't want to do it. You see, I know this. Whenever I get in front of a room full of people, I look for the angriest, grumpiest person there. Because deep down, they're the one that know they need to change the most. See, the one that's all happy about the sales training is going to do jack with it. It's the one that's seriously thinking about it. It's just like prospects. The happier the prospect, the less likely they are to buy. People who are going to spend money aren't like contestants on the Price is Right. Yay! They're actually, I don't know. It's a lot of money, yeah? They're going to spend money because they're at. So I get this, and I'll be in a room, and someone will say, you know what, Benjamin, if you did that to me, I'd tell you to. And then I do what I did. I go, what do you mean? Now, they don't see it now because they're so busy trying to convince me that if I did it to them, they'd see it. They don't see you doing it to them in that moment. And this is the thing. When you get a human being talking about themselves, they don't see you doing this. Now, when you first learn the Socratic method, as it's called, you will piss people off because you're going to be crap at it. Yeah, and you'll ask the wrong question in the wrong way, and it'll be, what? You know, like, where are you based? Is that important to you? Well, of course that's going to, that's a stupid answer to where are you based. You can't do that to someone. You've got to figure out, if somebody says, where are you based? I go, that's such a good guy. You know, no one ever asked me where, I'm happy to answer. Okay, quick, there must be a reason, though, you've asked me where we're based. I'm just curious. Okay, if I told you Bournemouth, what would you say? It's still a question. I haven't answered. I haven't said Bournemouth. I had a guy yesterday send me an email, and he goes, out of interest, what would it have taken for you to say no to me giving you a call? I go, well, let's pretend I told you that if your boss had refused to get on the call, that would have been a reason. Would you think that's fair? And he comes back, yeah. And I didn't actually answer the question. I didn't say that was the reason. I just said, what if I told you that was the case? What would you say? And he said, yeah. So people hear answers when there are none. Again, salespeople turn statements into questions. So a prospect will say to you something like, it's very expensive. They hear, it's expensive. Then they hear, justify and defend. Well, the reason why we charge what we charge is, but actually, no, listen, what did they, first of all, they made a statement. So I don't have to answer a statement. Second, what have they not said? They haven't said they can't afford it. They haven't said it's outrageous. They haven't said you're Dick Turpin. They haven't said they're looking for cheap. All they've said is it's very expensive, to which you should say, which means, and then they come back. What? Then they come back with what they mean.
The true objection.
The reason why I answer every question with a question is because 99% of the time, the first question asked is not the real question. So if somebody says, does it come in blue? And you say, it's interesting. No one ever asked me. Can I ask you why you've asked that? Yeah, I hate blue. Well, that's good to know. Yeah. Or are you a sales trainer? I go, what do you mean? They never say, are you a sales trainer again? They go, well, we're looking for one. Now, that's completely different from the first question. Yeah. Why would I answer it? So until I know why you've asked, I'm never going to answer. And because I know the first question is not the first question, I'm not going to answer it. But salespeople struggle with this because your whole life, you're programmed, you must answer a question when asked.
Understanding our programming and the behavior of ourselves and our customers is something I know you've got a big focus on. I think the term that I found was transactional analysis that you've gone really deep on.
Yeah.
What got you so interested in that?
Well, again, my colleague of mine, Mark, has introduced me to the psychology, and then I started reading, but there's so many books on transactional analysis. If you Google it, you'll be awash. It's all it is a model for understanding human communication. And like all the sciences, there are multiple models to explain. This one is very simple and easy to understand. It hasn't been discredited to my knowledge. And because it's so easy to understand, you're able to see what's happening in a conversation without boring your listeners. It just says that inside of us, there are three characters, an adult, a parent, and a child, and we flip between them at the speed of light. So right now, my adult bit of my brain is talking to your adult, because all I'm doing is imparting new information and facts, and your adult, the computer bit of your brain, is assessing it. Now, if I say something you don't like, you hear a little voice goes, I don't like that. That's your parent, because I've just said something that goes against the rule or a value that you believe to be true. So when I say never answer a question, you suddenly hear your mum say, I don't like him. Can't do that. That's wrong. Now, that's between you and your mum. It's not between me and you. So I had sales, but I can't do that. I said, well, take it up with your mum. It's not my problem, right? Yeah, so it teaches. So the chimp paradox is a modern version of that, and they give the difference. So as we say, everything under the sun's regurgitated, right? It's just repackaged and resold. So
chimp finding the source that speaks to you is vital, and your understanding of that, you can see it throughout your framework of communication. And you said you've got a process that involves some improv when somebody throws a curveball your way, because of course that comes up. We're human after all, and we come up with new things all the time. But I really like that you have a deep understanding of where particular questions are likely to get you towards. And when I scratch beneath the surface, I'm going to get to an answer that decides whether or not it's worth us moving forward. And yeah, I just find it fascinating when somebody's able to use something that they've read and studied and just constantly apply and test it, because nobody likes somebody that is all theoretical. It's why many of the academics I've had on the podcast, guess what? They've all produced either products or services or something off the back of the academia they've been involved in. They haven't just sat in their ivory tower at the University of Cambridge or wherever and just produced study after study. They've actually done something with the research, and that's what I find so valuable from that perspective.
Yes, I've always said I'm not an academic trainer. Everything I do, I teach, and everything I teach, I do. And that's one of the reasons why my clients stick with me, because I work in any sector. I don't know what 99% of my clients actually do. They all know that, but they know it's irrelevant because I'm able to help them to word and phrase it. I work with a company that sells food to children's nurseries. And within a matter of weeks, the CEO said, you have totally changed the way we talk about our product and you don't know anything about it. I said, no, I don't have to, but I know how we can word things. So I've been doing this for a long time, and I know I don't know anything about what my clients are, but I can figure out how to express it in a way that your prospect is going to understand. And it's a communication skill, not a selling skill. And we're not taught how to communicate properly. And I get people come to me and say, we've used other trainers. Academically, they can teach you. But when you say, how do you apply that in my world? They can only refer you back to the textbook. Whereas give me half an hour. I'll figure it out. I'll make a call in front of you and I'll show you how you do it. Because it's not that hard once you understand how to communicate with people.
Exactly that. Where did the brand, the UK's most hated sales trainer, come from?
So this developed, must have been about 2016 or 17. I can't remember exactly when. So I was starting out, and I there's a business motivational speaker, number one business a guy called Brad Burton. And
I've had Brad on the show. He's a legend, yeah.
He's a legend, right. So he used to own and run Four Networking. And I went... This is a true story, because me and Brad are still friends to this day. And it was one morning, 5:30 in the morning, my alarm had gone off, and I had to go all the way to Portsmouth for a Four Networking event. And this is when I was beginning my early days, and I was lying in bed, so I can't be asked. Bollocks to this. And then this voice just said, this is your job until you don't have to do it. So you've got to go. So I got up and I went. Turns out that morning, Brad was the guest speaker. The guy that owns the whole of Four Networking. I remember thinking, this is the only man I want to impress. So when I had to stand up and give my 30-second intro, I just let rip. And it worked, because Brad made a beeline for me and said, we should have a chat. And we had a chat, and I said to him, how did you become the number one business motivator? He said, page 26 of my book, look it up. So I got his book, page 26. How did I become the UK's number one? I made it up. And I phoned him up, and he said, I'm running a boot camp. Come on it. So I booked on his boot camp. And he said, if I was to say to you, I am the greatest, who do you think of? And I said, Muhammad Ali. He goes, exactly. But he wasn't the greatest boxer. He just kept saying it. And now anyone in boxing that comes along, if they ever say, I am the greatest, no, you're not. Everyone knows that was Muhammad Ali. So he found a space and he owned it. He goes, you need to do that for you, because you've got a unique style. So I went on LinkedIn and I looked at everyone who was in sales. And what do people in sales all refer to? And I hate it too. They like being liked. So everyone that thinks they're good at selling, top performer, number one, corporate leader, guru, expert, best performer. It's all this, look at me, how awesome I am. And that suddenly hit me. No one wants to be hated. So then I thought, I'll become the UK's most hated. So it makes no logical sense. It's got no... Then Trump came along with his hat. The most hated man on the planet, still to this day. And I saw that hat and I thought, oh, I'm nicking that. I'm just going to put salesman, red hat. Now I've got the character. And the hardest thing, this is true, the hardest thing would be standing up at a business events, introducing yourself. Hi, my name's Benjamin and I'm the UK's most hated. So it's so weird.
But creates now, massive intrigue, doesn't it?
Massive. And people come up to me and ask me like there's an actual body that measures hatred. Like it's a proper title. So how did you become the UK's most hated? So, like, I made it up. It's just good marketing. And and it's just worked. And yeah, because I figured no one else can come along now and say, no, I'm more hated, because that would just be stupid.
Exactly that. And I really like, as you say, Brad, genius piece of marketing, just branded himself it, and he just lived it and he embodied it, and now people use it in the same way you decided, let's do this. And it's also contrarian, which is vital in the field, particularly if you're going to lean into that character with the braces and the eccentricities that come with that. That's so important. Yeah. Given your brand is now so strong, how much prospecting do you still have to do when it comes to generating leads for your business?
Well, I always said to people, and I've always been upfront about this, the purpose of getting good at prospecting is so you never have to do it again. No one builds a business to want to be prospecting in it in 30 years. That's just dumb. The object is to build a business, a product, and a reputation where people come and give you money. Yeah? McDonald's doesn't sell anything. Everyone is in there to place an order, right? As long as they do good marketing and deliver the same rough quality, they'll always do fine. So I always was clear. My goal was to never have to prospect for myself again, which seemed like it would never happen until one day I realized I haven't been prospecting, because I was getting work in and so busy with the delivering the work that I wasn't able to prospect. So I haven't had to look for business, physically prospect for myself. I don't need to. I do prospecting with clients because I need to keep the skill up. I don't want to be one of those people that says, do what I say. So I can still do it. I occasionally make calls for myself. I'll be doing a load of my new platform. I've taken an interest in a particular business and I said I'd do the prospecting for this business. So I'm going to be recording myself prospecting for this business. I don't mind doing it. I hate it. I'm not going to lie. I think anyone that says, oh, I love prospecting, like, shut up. You can't love this.
I think we love what's on the other side of it. And you were speaking about salespeople wanting to be liked and validated. There is absolutely, because it's difficult, for me, I get a buzz from opening the door to businesses that other people couldn't get the door open to because my approach was better. I was more relentless in my approach and I just kept turning up and I filtered through all these different big accounts until I got into the big one that actually needed what I needed, what I was selling at that point in time, because timing's important as well, as we know. But it's so, so vital that you get a bit of a buzz from it, albeit the work should be a little bit difficult at that moment in time.
Like I say, I enjoy it when I do it, but I enjoy the fact that I don't have to do it in order to survive. See, when you have to do it, it becomes a bit of a mill chain. But now that I don't have to do it, it is enjoyable. And I still do. I don't know. I was doing some live cold calling on LinkedIn. And it's got to the point now when I phone someone, I phone and this guy goes, is that Benjamin? He goes, I'll meet with you. I said, no, that's not how this is supposed to work. This is supposed to be harder. So one of the reasons I have is if people hear me, they hear someone say, I'll be up front, this is a sales call, do you want to hang up? And it's a Kiwi voice. They instantly say, is that Benjamin? It's like, yeah, oh, I love your stuff.
That's because you've done the reps, though. You've done the reps. You built the brand. And that really, really counts for something. Genuinely, there's customers and clients that come back to me from a batch of prospecting I did really, really hard when I joined this business in 2021. Yeah. And I know that the seeds that you sowed back then, and you, if your approach was right and the timing was wrong for them then, they come back round because you're the person they think of when they think of your product or your service. And I really do believe, like a kind of Jocko Willick phrases, discipline equals freedom. And it really does. If you can be disciplined with your prospecting for a period of time, there comes a stage when your brand generates the opportunity for you to get leads and inbound inquiry off the back of that.
I prospected pretty much every day to grow my business for 4 years between 8:30 and 10:30, Monday to Friday. And Some days I wouldn't do it. Some days if I really didn't feel like doing, I wouldn't do it because I'm not a complete say. Sometimes if your mind is not there, then it's probably better not to do it because you're just going to waste. You maybe just that day you get through to someone you've always wanted to get through to and you're just not there. So sometimes I say this to people, don't be too hard on yourself. But if you're doing this every week, then there's a problem. But every now and then I take a day off. But basically 2 hours, 8:30 to 10:30. The reason why is most decision makers get in early. They're normally in before lots of other people. If the phone is ringing, they have a tendency to answer it. I could talk to five decision makers by 9:30. And I only wanted to talk to five a day, 25 a week. That's 100 a month. If I talk to 100, I'll get 8 to 12 meetings. I can't have all 12 closed. If I closed all 12, I'd be kind of screwed. So having more in the pipeline meant that when I got in front of people, I could then start practicing stuff. It's like, well, I've still got another 10 meetings this month, so it doesn't matter if I screw up. This is where detachment starts to build. I don't have to worry about it. I don't need this meeting because I've got another 8. But if you don't have that pipeline of meetings and you've only got 4 meetings and you need to get 4 deals, every one of those, you've got to can't fuck up. You're attached. So when people say, how do you grow detachment? Put in the bloody behavior so you've got enough people to be talking to that you can't sell to them all. But people don't do that. They do just enough to be relevant, just enough to get by. So you're constantly stuck in the rut. So do more than you have to. Yeah, and that's it. And it's all down to you. You can do it. You've just got to put in the effort. And the faster you do it, the quicker you'll be out of prospecting because you'll have clients paying you money and you won't need to do it. And then they tell other people about you and then other... Job done.
From a business perspective, I'm really interested to ask about some of the milestones that have come along the way that you believe have been like tipping points to get to where you are now, because as I said, your brand's so strong now, you're in a position of a lot of abundance. What led to that?
So there are some key markers along the way. I won't mention his name, but this one stands out. This one is because sometimes you don't know how good you've got because it's a gradual change. And I remember I was running a training seminar and we were doing cold calling and I told people to bring their own data and I said I would call. And one of the guys gave me a list of data and I started phoning through it. And I got through to the voicemail of the owner of a security company. And I didn't know who they were and I just left this voice message. The owner of this company called back 20 minutes later. And then I was able to do everything I taught live in front of the store. And I got an appointment. And the appointment was for like 6 weeks out, though. And I remember hanging up and then moving on with my life. And about 2 weeks before that, I got an email from the CEO's assistant saying, is the meeting still on? And I remember thinking, what the? I wasn't even going to meet him. I was just doing it for the exercise. And I thought, sod it. I'll go. So I thought, I better look up. I don't know who this... Turns out this was a massive FTSE listed company and this was the CEO and I had no idea. So I thought, all right, well, this will be it. I'll go to this one. This is worth my time. Get into this meeting. I spent an hour with the CEO and I'd done everything that I do. And he gets to the end of it. He goes, all right, Benjamin. He goes, this is where I'm at. He goes, I'm in. He goes, I don't even know what you're going to charge me. But the last hour, I have been so impressed with how you, I don't know what you do, but I just know I want to spend time with you. This guy, you know, drives a Lamborghini. He's worth tens of millions, very successful by British standards. And I remember walking out of that meeting and this voice just said, you must be pretty good if you've just done that and you've this person of such, you know, achievement.
Gotcha.
So that suddenly gave me a shot. It's like, you know, you are good. And then I did those two videos. Two videos came out about 6 weeks apart from each other. Again, there's no such thing as luck. It's preparation meets opportunity. So years of cold calling and getting good, years of putting myself out there. And I made that video of me on the couch. That was filmed in August 2018. I'd completely forgotten about it, but the guys put me on the spot. Make a cold call now live. And there were like 3 people behind the camera. There was all the guys on the couch. People don't notice, but in reality, I felt the phone do it. I was shaking. I was like this. All you see is me being so relaxed. But because part of me wanted to get a meeting. And there was a lot of pressure. Normally, I'm not attached to the outcome. But for this one, it's like, I need a meeting. And it went so well. The guy that filmed it, that owned the podcast, phoned me up in March of 2019. He goes, have you seen that video of you making that call? I said, no. He goes, mate, you got to watch it. It's just, it's gold. And I said, send it. And he sent it. And I said, oh, I don't even believe it's real. It looks just completely fake. He goes, I know. It's so good. I said, oh, I've got to put that on YouTube. I put that on YouTube. And before I knew it, like 150,000 views.
Yeah, it's on 400,000 now. It's just gone and gone and gone.
And off the back of that, I get the phone call from a CEO of a massive, I didn't know, the FX company. He lied to me. He said, I run a small boutique FX firm. Turns out it's the biggest one in the United Kingdom. Absolutely huge. Said, what would it cost to get you in to come in for a day to teach some of my guys what you do? I went in. They loved it. And we ended up working together for a year. Got me in every month, 3 days a month. He was paying me a nice big fee. And so you get these little markers. And when you got a room full of, you know, traders who are supposed to be really tough and grizzled, but yet they're hanging on to what you're teaching and say, can I do it in front of you? And say, God, this is good. So there's these little markers along the way, but you don't see them internally. It's not until something external sort of validates it for you. So like everyone, you have imposter syndrome. You know, sometimes I think someone's going to tell and say, come on, Benjamin, you're talking a load of crap. Get out. It's like, I do think that. And I still don't feel like a grown-up. I feel just like the same 18-year-old punk that I was. You know, I'm always surrounded by very successful people. And I get my wife, I said, it makes me laugh. There I am in braces and a red hat. And all these guys are. She goes, but you're successful. Like, I know, but I just feel like the idiot in the red hat. But it's good, though, because it keeps you humble, I guess. And I know I'm good at what I do, but I love seeing other people get good at it. I love it. Because selling is a miserable place if you're doing it badly. And so many people are doing it badly. If I can help, I don't know, a few thousand suddenly enjoy life and enjoy their job, then that is as rewarding as the money.
Exactly that. And there's a phrase that I use on the podcast a lot, a rising tide raises all ships. And it feels really good when you're being that rising tide. And I mentioned to you before we hit record that I think three of my listeners sent me your post when you said, guys, I normally say no to podcast invites, but I'm going to appear in a few more, slide into the DMs and let's get it booked. And I think at least two of those listeners have been on your courses and been through them and been like, you need to speak to Benjamin. I'd love to hear that, particularly given my background in sales as well. It made sense for us to have this conversation. I'm absolutely delighted that we did, Benjamin. I'm sure the listeners have really enjoyed it.
It's nice. I get emails from people all over the world. I've never met them. Just saying, I just want to let you know how much you've changed my life because I've binged on all your videos. And ever since I've started doing and thinking the way you think and doing what you do, my sales have got better. And it's just, it's nice. And it's like, you know, good for you. Yeah.
Keeps you going in the right direction. Yeah. Benjamin, I've loved this. I'm sure the listeners have as well. If they want to continue the conversation with you, where should they head towards?
So I've launched a new platform called salesmatrixcourses.com. It's a subscription model. It's being uploaded with new content all the time. There'll be over 200 hours next month, and it's added to every week with new courses, new interaction. There'll be a create. So people can go to that if they want to sign up to that. Or LinkedIn is where I hang out. That's where you can find me. Or obviously you visit my YouTube channel. And everything's all, with the exception of salesmatrixcourses.com, UK's most hated sales trainer. If you Google that, it's impossible not to find me, I think.
They can't miss you. That will all be linked in the show notes. Thank you to you, Benjamin. And thank you to you, the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.